911, where is your emergency?
At St. Patrick's Rectory.
Yes, what's the problem over there?
Our pastor fell, Father Ed fell.
Okay.
And he's in the rectory.
In the rectory?
Yes.
Okay.
On the 23rd of October 2009, the small town of Chatham, New Jersey, gathered at St. Patrick's Church. They expected to see the priest, but they were met with an eerie silence. The search for the missing priest would reveal that darkness can lurk in even the most unexpected of places, and sometimes wolves can conceal themselves in sheep's clothing. Edward Hines was born in Chatham, New Jersey, where he attended Morristown High School, followed by Selton Hall University. Chatham is known as a New York bedroom community, boasting of around 10,000 residents with a median income of $132,000. It's certainly a desirable place to raise a family, and as Edward grew, he saw no reason to leave the town he had grown to love. His deep faith led him to enter the seminary at just 21 years old, where he was sent by the diocese to study theology in the heart of Rome. It was there that he was ordained as a priest on the 27th of June 1974, at the youthful age of 25, quickly becoming known as Father Ed to the community. For 4 years, he served as a pastoral assistant at St. Patrick's Church before being appointed as the Vice-Chancellor of the Diocese of Paterson and Secretary to Bishop Frank Rodimer, where he served until 1989. During his tenure, he also served as a dedicated pastor to the faithful of St. Michael Church in Net Cong and Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in Boonton. While at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, Father Ed oversaw various capital improvements that were undertaken for the anniversary in 1997. This included roof repairs, new stained glass doorways, new masonry and landscaping. As Kenneth Latch, a retired priest and close friend of Father Ed, said, "Ed was a quiet man, genuinely kind, and a priest in the best sense of the world. He was an excellent spiritual leader. He sincerely wanted to be the best pastor he could to all people." Then in 2003, Father Ed returned to St. Patrick's Church, where he was appointed as the pastor. St. Patrick's is a bustling parish with a congregation of approximately 1,600 devoted parishioners. As part of his new role, he moved into the two-story church rectory where he resided alone. Described by many as a man of exceptional character, Father Ed was widely admired for his unwavering faith and compassionate nature. Those who knew him spoke of his gentle spirit, keen insight, and warm personality. His generosity and selflessness were renowned throughout the community, and he never hesitated to lend a helping hand to those in need. With his deep faith and boundless compassion, Father Ed was well suited to his role as a priest, and he was deeply committed to serving the spiritual needs of his congregation. He was beloved by his parishioners, who looked up to him as a leader and a friend. Despite the demands of his pastoral duties, Father always made time for those in his community, offering comfort, guidance, and support to anybody who needed it. Father Ed was also a man of action, always striving to improve the church and ensure that its operations ran smoothly. He wasted no time in launching a comprehensive effort to identify areas that could benefit from upgrades. To this end, he distributed surveys among the church community, seeking their input on everything from outreach and ministry programs to upkeep of the church itself. The surveys were meticulously crafted, with detailed questions designed to elicit thoughtful, actionable feedback. Father Ed pored over each response, carefully considering the insights offered by parishioners from all walks of life. As he sifted through the survey results, Father Ed became increasingly concerned about the church's financial situation. It quickly became apparent that many parishioners shared these worries, and he knew that he needed to take action. Regrettably, this meant making some difficult decisions, including letting go of 3 church employees. One survey question stood out in particular. Have we seen a detailed budget reviewing of costs of staff, budget of ministries, etc.? This question struck a chord with Father Ed, reminding him of the importance of careful financial planning in the church. Despite the challenges ahead, he was determined to steer the church towards a brighter future, one that was rooted in financial stability and responsible stewardship. Although St. Patrick serves a wealthy community, Father Ed ran several outreach programs to help the homeless in other areas. His church had a reputation as a beacon for those in need. That didn't just mean homeless people, but those short of cash. Father Ed was always on hand to provide cash for gasoline or whatever else was needed. As Reverend Owen Moran from St. Rose said, "People knock on the door late at night all the time. It's up to the person to decide whether to open the door and help them out." And he was always helping people. Father Ed also served as a chaplain for the local fire department, and in his free time he loved to go golfing. He was known for a golf shot that was straight and effective. In 2009, 61-year-old Father Ed welcomed somebody else into the fold. It was a Cocker Spaniel who he named Ginger. She lived in the rectory with Father Ed, providing companionship and comfort, and he took great pleasure walking her around the neighbourhoods several times a day. This always included a late-night walk around 9 p.m. before bed. That year, life was looking good for Father Ed. He was looking forward to an upcoming trip in 2010 to Rome, where he was going to visit classmates from his seminar days at the Pontifical North American College, a school close to the Vatican for highly regarded seminarians. Arlene Kant, a longtime friend, stated, "He was an exceptional, exceptional man. He didn't offend anybody. He didn't take on issues. He didn't use the pulpit to take on anything political. A lot of the time he'd talk and he'd say, 'Well, where's God in this?' That's the kind of man he was." On Friday, the 23rd of October 2009, congregants at St. Patrick's Church arrived for their Mass service. 8 a.m. came and went, and Father Ed was a no-show. The congregants were perplexed. Father Ed had never been late for a service. Not wanting the congregation to wait any longer, a church deacon and Jose Feliciano, the church's janitor, decided to go in search for Father Ed. They entered the rectory kitchen, where their eyes were immediately transfixed to the pools of blood on the floor. There was blood on the kitchen counter, and nearby the telephone had been ripped from their wall. Their eyes followed the blood to find the source of it. On the floor, they found Father Ed crumpled in a ball. He was fully outfitted in formal black garb, which was stained with blood. Ginger was sitting close to Father Ed's body, unharmed but under a serious amount of stress. Jose Feliciano crouched down beside Father Ed and began attempting life-saving measures in the form of compressions. He turned to the deacon and solemnly stated, "There's nothing we can do." Father Ed was far beyond saving. He had been stabbed a total of 44 times on the neck, face and torso, and even the back of his head. There were defensive wounds to his hands and bruises to his face, indicating that he had fought fiercely for his life, but to no avail. At 8:03 a.m, just 3 minutes after Mass should have begun, a 911 call came into police to report the incident, although the caller wasn't yet aware that Father Ed had been stabbed. He thought that he had simply fallen.
"911, where's your emergency?" In Chatham?
Where in Chatham?
St. Patrick's Church.
St. Patrick's Church? What's the problem?
Our priest has fallen and looks like he's unconscious.
Okay, and where is he located at the church?
Washington. He's in the rectory.
In the rectory? Okay, so go in from the Washington Avenue 5?
No, that's fine.
Okay, is someone else there?
Yes.
Okay, is the door open?
The door will be open.
Tell him to go into the rectory side door of off Washington. I'm going to put you through to the medics for pre-arrival. The priest fell. He's unconscious. Hold on. WPGB 230, Chatham Emergency Squad, you're responding into the borough. 85 Washington Avenue, St. Patrick's Church, in the rectory off of Washington Avenue. Male fell, is unconscious. Roll the borough rig. Check that, roll the township rig. Repeating, WPGB 230, Chatham Emergency Squad, you're responding into the borough. 85 Washington Avenue, the rectory of St. Patrick's Church. Go in the side door. Male fell, is unconscious. Roll the township rig. Time 0806, number 438. Sir?
Deacon Joseph Wisniewski came into the church and told all of the parishioners that service was not going to be held, and that Father Ed had an accident, and he asked everybody to pray for him. By the stricken look on the deacon's face, however, many could tell that something was seriously wrong. Meanwhile, a second phone call came into police from another member of the church.
911, where is your emergency?
At St. Patrick's Rectory.
I think we have somebody on the other line, 911.
Okay.
What's the problem over there?
Okay,
where
is he located at the church?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, what's the problem over there?
Our pastor fell, Father Ed fell.
Okay.
And he's in the rectory.
In the rectory?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
Investigators immediately descended on the scene. It took them just seconds to take in the carnage before them. Father Ed was lying in the middle of the kitchen floor. He was on his back with his eyes closed. There were knife wounds mostly to the chest area, and he was covered in blood. Detective Kelly Zenowicz recalled of the scene. What stood out was that a pedestal based on the table clearly had blood on it, and quite a lot of blood was transferred onto the walls. It appeared as though someone was underneath the table, bleeding through their clothing. The brutal murder had a profound impact on the small, peaceful town, where violent crimes were a rare occurrence. The community was shaken to its core, and a pervasive sense of fear gripped the streets. The possibility of a sadistic killer on the loose loomed over the town, casting a shadow of uncertainty over daily life. Parents removed their children from the parish school as it went into lockdown. For Janet Gilmartin, who lived just across the street from the crime scene, the fear was particularly acute. She commented in the media that she couldn't help but wonder if the killer had been lurking in the area when she had been outside with her daughter and grandson earlier that morning. Janet expressed the community's sense of horror, stating, "It's frightening to think that the person who did this thing might have been running across the street this morning when my daughter was stopping outside to take my grandson to school." Investigators closed several roads around the St. Patrick's campus and began their investigation. Prosecutor Robert Bianchi warned the community to remain vigilant, that there was a killer on the loose. Chatham Mayor Nelson Vaughan stated, "This is almost unbelievable. I've lived here since 1950, and this is the second homicide in town I know of. It's a peaceful, quiet, and friendly town." Meanwhile, Father Ed's body was transported to the medical examiner's office, where it was found that he had sustained 44 separate stab wounds. 6 wounds were fatal, including one to the neck that was deep enough it fractured the windpipe. 5 other wounds to his chest broke ribs and perforated the diaphragm. The injuries were so severe that more than a third of Father Ed's blood was not in a blood vessel. The pathologist also noted that blood spatter indicated that both Father Ed and his killer were moving as the attack unfolded. Investigators were keen to identify a suspect in the murder, but they, the same as everybody else, were baffled. Father Ed did not have an enemy in the world. Bishop Arthur Saratelli of the Diocese of Paterson stated, "This makes no sense. There would be no reason for anybody to do this." In fact, all throughout Father Ed's life and career, he had never received one complaint nor one disciplinary action. Immediately, the first theory that crossed everyone's mind was that Father Ed had been killed by somebody he had opened up his arms to during their time of need. Prosecutor Bianchi commented, "Maybe one of those individuals was involved. That kind of generosity is preyed upon." Investigators quickly began retracing Father Ed's last known movements to try and establish exactly when he was killed. The night before his body was discovered, there had been a safety seminar held by police in the church. During the seminar, they fingerprinted and photographed young children. It was noted that Father Ed wasn't present, which was extremely unusual. Anytime there was an event at the church, Father Ed would always make an appearance. As the hours continued to pass, a makeshift memorial appeared at 85 Washington Avenue. Members of the community brought along tokens of condolences, including candles and flowers. There were hand-drawn cards from the children at the church's elementary school. One woman, Sharon Nooner, commented to the media how Father Ed had visited her son every day after he was born and kept in the neonatal intensive care unit. Her eyes welled with tears as she added, "He was a good man." Father Owen B. Moran, the pastor at St. Rose of Lima Church in East Hanover, was appointed temporary spiritual leader of St. Patrick's Church, and at 8 a.m. the next morning, he officiated the first Mass since Father Ed's passing. The church's website was updated with a photograph of Father Ed along with the poignant message, "We, the parish of St. Patrick, mourn the tragic death of our beloved pastor, Ed Hines. We pray for the repose of his soul. We pray for courage and strength during this sad and difficult time." As the investigation into the murder was underway, it was uncovered that a 911 call had come into local police around 5:30 p.m. the evening before Father Ed's body was discovered. It was from a man who was struggling to speak. He said that he needed help at 85 Washington Avenue, the address of the church.
911, where's your emergency?
85 Washington Avenue.
Washington Avenue? Hello? Hello? Hello?
The phone call then went muffled before the line went dead. The operator called back and it went straight to voicemail. They called back a second time and somebody else picked up the phone and said that they didn't need help. In the background, however, another man's voice can be heard stating, "Yes, we do."
"Oh. Sir, this is the state police. You called 911. Do you have an emergency?"
"No, you don't. Thank you.
No?
Hello, no. Thank you.
All right."
Unfortunately, the call had come from a cell phone and it couldn't be traced. While the state had spent at least $60 million on upgrades in the past 5 years, outdated phone technology still hampered emergency efforts. However, the caller had given 85 Washington Avenue as the address for the emergency, which was the address of St. Patrick's Church. Investigators theorized that this first phone call was from Father Ed during the assault that cost him his life. They speculated that when they called back, it was Father Ed's killer who picked up and said that help wasn't needed. For reasons unknown, the 911 operator didn't think to send help. Investigators were keen to see if there were any potential clues on Father Ed's cell phone that could lead them to a potential suspect. They were curious to see if maybe he'd made an appointment to meet somebody that could shed some light on the circumstances surrounding his murder. However, after an exhaustive search at the rectory, Father Ed's cell phone couldn't be found. Naturally, investigators assumed that his killer had stolen it and decided that they needed to track it down immediately. It led them to a home in Easton, Pennsylvania. They immediately descended on the home and pounded on the front door. They waited for a response, and after a tense few moments, a man opened up the front door. They recognized the man right away. Standing less than 1 foot away from the investigators was 64-year-old Jose Feliciano, the janitor at St. Patrick's Church, who had found Father Ed's body. Feliciano immediately waived his Miranda rights and made a full confession to Father Ed's murder. He told investigators that he and Father Ed had gotten into an argument while at the rectory over the prospect of Feliciano losing his job. He claimed that after the argument he turned away, but Father Ed grabbed him. He alleged that a scuffle ensued, during which he grabbed a knife and stabbed Father Ed repeatedly. Feliciano was arrested and charged with murder and possession of a weapon. His arrest came as a massive shock to the entire community. Much like Father Ed, he too was a familiar face in the town. He had been working as custodian at the church since 1992, and he and his family had at one stage lived in a house on the church's grounds. His son had graduated from the Catholic school associated with the church, and his daughter was currently enrolled there. He too was described as a devoted Catholic and a dedicated family man who brought meals to his neighbours whenever they were sick. One of them, Joshua Kaiser, said, "You would think he was pushed to do it. It seemed that something would have to happen to do that." In fact, some within the community even said that Feliciano was seen as a second father to many children in St. Patrick's. Charlie Spencer, a longtime parishioner at the church, revealed to the public that Feliciano had been sick in recent months, and he wondered whether something had snapped in his mind. The community would soon come to learn that Feliciano wasn't exactly who he said he was. As mentioned, he had begun working as custodian at St. Patrick's Church back in 1992. At the time of Father Ed's murder, he had been considering some staffing changes due to financial issues. On the chopping block was Feliciano. He and his wife, Marisol, had been struggling financially. Both of them worked two jobs, but earlier in the year, Feliciano had left his second job at an electronics store. One of the neighbours of the couple recalled, "They had very long days. They would leave the house at 5:30 a.m. and wouldn't get back home until 7:30 or 8:30 at night." Father Ed had just recently performed a background check on Feliciano and learned that he had an arrest warrant in Philadelphia from 1988 for indecent assault without consent, simple assault, and corruption of a minor. He had touched a woman's 7-year-old daughter in an inappropriate manner. Since then, Feliciano had used fake names and fake identities for decades to hide his past. On the 2nd of April 1988, he had been arrested, but he failed to appear for his hearing the following month, at which time a bench warrant was issued. He had adopted various aliases, including Carlos Feliciano and Jose Lobo, and had changed his date of birth and social security number several times. Father Ed had discovered that Feliciano's employment history lacked the necessary documentation to confirm that he had successfully passed a background check. He had never provided a fingerprint background check. The discovery was brought to Father Ed's attention due to a recent diocesan push to ensure that all parishes and schools were in strict compliance with the policies surrounding criminal background checks for every single employee. Going back to 1986, state laws mandated the public schools perform background checks on their staff. 3 years later, private and religious institutions were granted access to government resources for the same purpose. Although it wasn't a requirement, all 5 Roman Catholic dioceses in the state implemented this measure immediately. The clergy sex abuse scandal that rocked the Catholic Church in 2003 led to a change in policy. In addition to employees, volunteers were also mandated to undergo background checks. Kenneth Mullaney, an attorney for the Paterson Diocese, said, "In March, it just so happens we re-emphasised and redoubled our efforts to ensure that every single school, every single parish, was compliant. My speculation is that perhaps the current issue had to do with that effort." Father Ed had used two different websites to research Feliciano's background and to pay for the services with his credit card. Upon making the ominous discovery, Father Ed told the principal of St. Patrick's Church, Marion Hobby, that he would need to fire Feliciano. This was evidently what the argument at the church had been about. After killing Father Ed, Feliciano attempted to clean up the crime scene, mopping up some blood with rags. It had been a frenzied attack and Feliciano's t-shirt was stained with blood. He took it off and along with the rags he tossed them into a black plastic bag. He then stole Father Ed's cell phone and waited for his wife and daughter to collect him following his shift. He disposed of the plastic bag in a garbage can in a park around 50 yards from his home. After Feliciano's confession, investigators found Father Ed's cell phone and the murder weapon inside his home. They then found the bloody t-shirt and rags in the bin in the park. The following morning, around 300 mourners gathered at St. Patrick's Church School for a memorial mass for Father Ed. They arrived in small groups and took their seats to reminisce about Father Ed. Joe Garrison, a parishioner, stated, "For the leader of our church to be taken down this way, we just feel awful." Kenneth Lash had been handpicked by Father Ed before his death to deliver his eulogy in the event of his death. Amongst themselves, the mourners spoke about Father Ed and Feliciano. The regular Sunday service came on Sunday, and that service was led by Reverend Owen Moran, who stood in for Father Ed. He said to the parishioners, "Father Ed would have forgiven Jose. He probably had forgiven him before he died." His comment was met by grumbles of displeasure. Meanwhile, investigators began looking into the 911 call that had preceded Father Ed's murder. The voices on the phone call had been identified as Father Ed and Feliciano. 911 calls from cell phones are routinely routed through headquarters in West Trenton. Captain Gerald Lewis announced his agency would be looking into whether one of his dispatchers handled the call, and if so, they were going to investigate how it was handled. As the end of October approached, the community gathered at St. Patrick's Church to pay their respects to Father Ed. The sombre atmosphere was palpable as mourners filed into the church, their faces etched with grief. Father Ed's casket was brought in through a row of members of the fire department that stood guard outside. His casket was placed at the front of the church, and the service was led by Reverend Moran, who spoke passionately about Father Ed's life and work. He stated, "One of his attributes was that he was very kind with the sick and dying, preparing and counselling their families." Over 1,000 mourners attended the viewing, a testament to Father Ed's legacy. The rite of reception of the body marked the beginning of the ceremony, as priests from all over northern New Jersey paid their final respects. Reverend Martin McDonnell of St. Anthony Parish echoed the sentiments of many, speaking of Father Ed's deep love for his parishioners and fellow priests. Early the next month, State Police Lieutenant Gerald Lewis said that a preliminary investigation into the 911 call that Father Ed had made concluded that the operator had followed proper procedure. The case was moving through the justice system when early the next year, it was announced that Reverend Robert Mitchell was taking over Father Ed's role at St. Patrick's Church. He became known to the community as Father Bob, and they welcomed him with open arms. Meanwhile, a grand jury indicted Feliciano on charges of murder, robbery, weapons offences, and hindering apprehension. The grand jury also handed up a finding of aggravating factors that the murder was outrageously vile, horrible or inhuman, and that it involved torture or depravity of the mind. These findings could lead to a stricter sentence if Feliciano were convicted. As the congregation continued to mourn Father Ed, they were continuing to practice what they preached. Feliciano's daughter was still attending the church's elementary school, and his wife Marisol remained a member of the Home and School Parish Association. Church trustee John Polonin commented in the media, "The parish community will be glad to know the process is moving forward. An indictment is an important step. We're glad to know the prosecutor is making this a priority so we can have some closure." He also said that everybody in the church community was trying to forgive and allowed Feliciano's family to remain at the church. Then in March, Feliciano pleaded not guilty to all of the charges against him. While Feliciano had made a confession to Father Ed's murder, as his trial date was approaching, it became apparent he was seeking a new defense. According to Feliciano, he had been having a 4-year sexual affair with Father Ed. He now claimed that he told Father Ed on the evening of his murder that he no longer wanted to be in the relationship. He then claimed that Father Ed told him that if he didn't continue the relationship, then he would be fired. During the confession, Feliciano had stated, "I couldn't have a relationship with him anymore. I'm not gay." He further said that he stabbed Father Ed a lot of times before adding, "I felt so sorry for him." Feliciano then broke down in sobs, and through those sobs he stated, "My poor wife." According to Feliciano, while he was a young boy, he was sexually abused a number of times by a priest in Brooklyn. He said that he had told Father Ed about this 5 years earlier and claimed that he was defensive, but also had done some counselling with Father Ed. He said that around a year later, Father Ed had come to him with the possibility of letting him go. He then added, "And he started touching me all over. He started touching my privacy." Feliciano said to the investigators that he didn't like being touched by Father Ed, but he had reminded him about his employment. He stated, "Then before you know it, he was having a relationship with me." The prosecution immediately countered this. The thorough investigation into Father Ed's murder had proved beyond a doubt that he had uncovered the truth about Feliciano's seedy past and was preparing to fire him. While past criminal history isn't always permitted as evidence in a trial, Assistant Prosecutor John McNamara Jr. argued that Feliciano's past lies were at the heart of the murder of Father Ed. He also revealed that there hadn't been a shred of evidence to back up the claims of a love affair between the two men. Prosecutor McNamara wrote, "The investigation into the defendant's criminal history is relevant to impeach his self-serving claim that he had a homosexual relationship with the victim as the basis for stabbing the victim dozens of times." Feliciano's defense attorney Neil Hamilton then claimed that Feliciano had made the confession while in the hospital psychiatric ward, and that he may have been affected by prescription drugs at the time. He said he was in the process of finding out what medication, if any, Feliciano was under at the time, and whether it had any effect on his voluntary statement in which he confessed to the murder. As these issues were being ironed out in court, a grand jury issued a revised indictment. It was essentially the same, but added a second count of first-degree robbery for the theft of Father Ed's cell phone. In October, Feliciano was seeking a new defense, an insanity defense. Defense attorney Hamilton said that he was going to file a notice of said defense for Feliciano. However, in February the following year, it was announced that Feliciano was no longer pursuing an insanity defense. The defense then claimed that Feliciano had been tricked into believing that he would get favourable treatment if he told the truth about Father Ed's murder to the investigators. Defense Attorney Hamilton argued that Captain Jeffrey Paul had made Feliciano feel so comfortable during his interview that he didn't want the captain to leave the room. He said that Captain Paul told Feliciano he had a relative at the hospital, but this wasn't true. He accused him of trying to gain a report with Feliciano. Captain Paul responded, "I was talking to a killer. I didn't have a problem." Captain Paul was asked whether he told Feliciano his family would benefit if he told the truth. And he confirmed he told Feliciano he would make an effort to ensure his daughter could remain at the school, which she did. The judge ultimately ruled that the confession could be entered into evidence in the upcoming murder trial. It was scheduled for the middle of 2011. But during a pre-trial hearing, Feliciano experienced dizziness, chest palpitations, and shortness of breath. After he left the courtroom, he fell out of his wheelchair and was transported to hospital, pushing the trial back. In July of 2011, a plea deal was offered to Feliciano. In exchange for a guilty plea to the murder and robbery, prosecutors would be seeking a sentence of 30 years to life in prison. He rejected the deal, and jury selection for the upcoming trial began. While this was ongoing, investigators uncovered some more disturbing information about Feliciano's background. It was uncovered that he had impregnated his 11-year-old stepdaughter years earlier. The prosecution revealed that if Feliciano were to take the witness stand, they would question him on this as well as question him on the indecent assault charge against the 7-year-old girl. On the 20th of October 2011, the courtroom was filled with an air of anticipation as the jury was selected and the trial was ready to begin. Prosecutor Robert Bianchi stepped forward to deliver his opening statements. He painted a vivid picture of Feliciano as a cold and calculated liar who had meticulously planned the murder and cover-up. His voice bellowed through the courtroom as he detailed the lengths that Feliciano had gone to carry out the crime, including stealing Father Ed's cell phone and ripping the rectory telephone from the wall. He then revealed a shocking piece of evidence to back up the claims that Father Ed was firing Feliciano. He had written, "Jose, last day," beside the date October 23rd in his calendar. He then played aloud the 911 call that Father had made, followed by the callback phone call. He then stated, "That's a man who is deceiving, covering up his crime, a liar, a fabricator, that doesn't care he's murdering another human being." The defense team, however, had a different story to tell. They claimed that Feliciano had acted under immense pressure against alleged threats from Father Ed, ultimately causing him to snap. Defense attorney Hamilton didn't mention explicitly the allegations of the affair that Feliciano had made, but defense attorney Hamilton alluded to the high price Father Ed had forced Feliciano to pay in exchange for keeping quiet about the discovery of his seedy past. Defense attorney Hamilton questioned why, if Father Ed had discovered this information out, did he not automatically fire Feliciano? He said that Father Ed waited until a compliance audit of the church, which was just 1 week away. He said, "For the price Father Ed made Mr. Feliciano pay, for the things he made Mr. Feliciano do, he provoked Mr. Feliciano so much that a reasonable person would fly into a homicidal rage." It was evident from his statement that the defense was arguing that Father Ed had held the information he uncovered about Feliciano over his head as a way to continue the alleged affair that they were having. They were going down the passion, provocation, manslaughter route and weren't denying that Feliciano had killed Father Ed. The reason that there was no mention of the alleged affair was because Judge Thomas Manahan had ruled that it could not be made during opening statements and it could only be brought up if Feliciano testified. On the first day of the trial, evidence was presented regarding the murder weapon. It had been found just across the street from where Feliciano had lived. There was also evidence that Father Ed's cell phone, which was found snapped in half near Feliciano's home. He had told investigators where to find these pieces of evidence. They also recovered bloodstained clothing and bloodstained towels. DNA testing on these items came back as a match for Father Ed's blood. Afterwards, the jury once more heard the 911 call that Father Ed had made. His friend, Justin Ann Kong, identified the voice as his. She broke down as she stated, "It sounds like Ed. It sounds like he's tortured, like he's in pain." The jury also heard about the digging Father Ed had done on Feliciano in order to uncover his criminal history. After learning about his past, Father Ed was sent information about the charges against Feliciano by a Pennsylvania state trooper. It was also disclosed during trial that a supervisor at the church had wanted to fire Feliciano long before his past was uncovered. According to maintenance supervisor John Gallagher, Feliciano was always leaving the buildings dirty. However, top officials, including Father Ed, didn't want to fire him because he was only a couple of months away from retirement age. Father Ed was concerned for Feliciano's family and hoped that he would retire on his own. Virginia Donnellan, church business administrator, testified that Feliciano was aware that John wasn't satisfied with his work quality. She said that one day Feliciano came to her very nervous and spoke about the prospect of being fired. She stated, "He was shaking, very distraught, and in near tears. His head was bowed down. I found his behaviour almost offensive. He was being too subservient. Sometimes I felt he was putting on an act to get the reaction he wanted out of me." While Father Ed had wanted to keep Feliciano on, when he found out about his prior history, he had no other option than to fire him. Afterwards, the jury would hear statements between investigators and Feliciano's 14-year-old daughter. She hadn't been required to testify, but the comments she made to investigators were allowed to be presented. She told investigators that on the day that Father Ed was killed, her father wasn't his usual jovial self. Her mother picked both her and her father up from church, like she always did, but that day, her father was 15 minutes late. This was when he was carrying out the murder. After getting into the car, Feliciano only said that he was busy. He was quiet on the way home and not telling jokes and stories like he normally did on their drive back home. When they arrived, Feliciano had a shower and then walked the dog. This was when he disposed of the evidence. She testified that her father had been worried about losing his job. Robert Cager, a volunteer who worked lunch at St. Patrick's School, testified about Feliciano's demeanour that same day as well. He said that at lunchtime, Feliciano was usually upbeat and happy as he gave milk to students and cleaned tables. This day, however, he said that Feliciano sat with his head down and he wasn't helping. He testified, "He looked like he had the weight of the world on his shoulders." The prosecution speculated that Feliciano had been fired by Father Ed that morning. His calendar listed a meeting with Feliciano at 9:45 a.m., along with the note, "Jose's last day." This indicated that Feliciano's last day would be the following day. Maria Lutz Cleves testified next, and she said that at the end of the workday, Feliciano appeared to be rushed and said he needed to leave quickly because there was something he needed to do. This was around 30 minutes before Father Ed was stabbed to death. This supported the prosecution's theory that the murder had been premeditated. After this, the prosecution rested their case and it was now time for the defence to present theirs. They called on John Bongo, a fellow ex-custodian at the church. He was fired a year before the murder and he testified that Father Ed had told him, "I hate to do this, but because of budget cuts and the financial situation at the parish, we have to lay you off." He claimed that the church was suffering because some parishioners were leaving due to dissatisfaction with Father Ed. He stated, "Sometimes he'd say hi and other times he'd blow right by you not saying anything." Under cross-examination by the prosecution, he said he wasn't aware of any romantic relationship between Father Ed and Feliciano and admitted that he told investigators that if there were any kind of relationship, he would have known. After his testimony, Feliciano took to the witness stand. The courtroom fell silent as he claimed that Father Ed had touched him sexually in exchange for keeping silent about the criminal charges he was facing. He claimed that in 2003 he told Father Ed he couldn't comply with the fingerprinting program because of an outstanding warrant.
When he ran my privacy, I pushed him to the side and I said, Father, what are you doing? What are you touching me in my privacy? His response was, not to worry about it. He ran my privacy really hard. And he started grabbing himself.
Mr. Feliciano, how did that make you feel?
He made me feel really bad. Made me feel very crappy. Very crappy. Because I had a lot of admiration for Father Ed.
He claimed that Father Ed told him not to worry, but then changed his tune the following year, when he disclosed the charge related to an incident involving a child. He said that Father Ed was upset about the revelation and ordered him and his family to move out of a church-owned property, which they did. Feliciano claimed that for the next 4 years he allowed Father Ed to touch him privately in exchange for his silence. His testimony, however, didn't match up with Father Ed's internet searches, which showed that he had only just discovered Feliciano's past. According to Feliciano, Father Ed called him into the rectory and fired him. He stated, "All this time he's been using me, and now he's saying I have to go. I told him, you promised me. We got into a very heated argument and I pleaded with him not to do that to me." He said that Father Ed then began to belittle him and said that he was like a child, crying and begging. Feliciano told the jury that it was at this stage he noticed the knife on the table. He said he grabbed it and went crazy. Prosecutor Bianchi poked holes in Feliciano's testimony and pointed out discrepancies between his court testimony and statements he gave to police.
There's a lot of things that you've just testified to under oath here before this jury that are very different than what you said
objection.
In your statement.
No, sir. Really.
Objection.
No, sir. Not really.
Objection.
Not yes, really, sir.
He asked, "Is your memory of the incident better now than it was right after it happened?" The difference between his statements were that Feliciano was now claiming that Father Ed had indeed fired him. However, during his confession, there was absolutely no mention of this. He claimed during his confession that the argument was about Feliciano attempting to end the relationship. Moreover, Feliciano was now claiming that he was retiring, so it wouldn't matter whether he lost his job or not. He hadn't mentioned this at all during his confession. He now claimed that Father Ed had made a promise to him to allow him to work until he turned 65 in March of 2010. Feliciano then admitted that he lied during the first 82 pages of the interview when he first of all denied the murder. He stated, "I didn't want to get caught. I didn't want anybody to know." The confession had only come when Feliciano was informed of the evidence collected against him, including the fact that Father Ed's cell phone was pinging to towers alongside his home. During cross-examination, Feliciano agreed that he would have been fired and his reputation would have been obliterated if the criminal charges he faced were revealed. He also disclosed that his wife and daughter had no knowledge about his earlier charges. After his testimony, Sister Catherine Morstedt testified. She had counseled Feliciano and he claimed to investigators that he was sexually abused by a priest when he was a young boy. He maintained he had told Father Ed and Sister Catherine about this, but when she took to the witness stand, she denied that he had ever mentioned it to her. She said that he was troubled instead by gang activity as a young man. Furthermore, she revealed that he had expressed tremendous respect and appreciation for Father Ed, and said he had welcomed him and his family into their community. She also countered his claim that Father Ed had forced him and his family to move out of the house on the grounds of St. Patrick's. She said the real reason they moved out was because the parish wanted to sell the house. She said that Feliciano appeared to be excited about moving out. As she said, It was the American dream for them. As the trial drew to a close, both the prosecutor and defense attorney presented their final arguments to the jury. Prosecutor Bianchi painted a vivid picture of the defendant, Feliciano, as a meticulous and self-absorbed individual with a shady past, who had meticulously planned the murder of Father Ed as a desperate attempt to salvage his reputation. On the other hand, defense attorney Hamilton portrayed him as a victim of sexual blackmail, who had been pushed to the brink and lost control of his actions. The fate of Feliciano now rested in the hands of the jury, who had the arduous task of determining whether his actions constituted murder or manslaughter. The jury took their time, deliberating for 5 painstaking hours before arriving at a verdict. It was a moment of great anticipation as everyone held their breath, waiting to hear the decision.
On the charge of felony murder, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty of felony murder.
On the charge of possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, how do you find the defendant?
Fine.
Guilty.
On the charge of unlawful possession of a weapon, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty.
On the charge of hindering his own apprehension, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty.
On the charge of murder, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty of murder.
On the charge of robbery, how do you find the defendant?
Guilty of robbery.
Jose Feliciano was found guilty of the murder of Father Ed, and his claims of provocation was swiftly dismissed. In addition, he was found guilty on 2 counts of robbery, hindering apprehension, and 2 weapons charges. The decision was a welcome relief to all of those who loved Father Ed. Outside of court, his cousin, Daniel Silas Miller, stated, "The happy part is that his reputation gets restored. It was just disgusting. It's like he was slaughtered twice. Everything this man has said was nothing but lies and a farce to save his own skin. It's a shame that this pig was able to take such a precious commodity from our community. Ed Hines was a good man." Prosecutor Bianchi also commented, "I'm proud and honoured to have been part of a process to vindicate Father Hines' murder and the slander of his reputation, which obviously the jury soundly did not believe. I can think of no greater Christmas gift to Father Hines' soul and for those who loved him, that this conviction happens at Christmas time." On the 20th of April 2012, the courtroom was filled with tense anticipation as everyone awaited the sentencing of Jose Feliciano. Prosecutor Bianchi once again addressed the court, making reference to Feliciano's claims of sexual blackmail. Despite a thorough investigation, not a shred of evidence could be found to support his outrageous allegations. The family of Father Ed were present, along with other members of the parish who held him dear. The case was especially disturbing due to the vile accusation that had been made against Father Ed, a man who was universally loved for his gentle, kind nature. Feliciano, on the other hand, had led a life of deceit, with multiple identities and a long history of disturbing crimes against children. He had even impregnated his own stepdaughter, a fact that wasn't allowed to be mentioned during trial. Prosecutor Bianchi became emotional as he asked Judge Thomas Manahan to impose the maximum sentence. The judge did just that. He sentenced Jose Feliciano to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Before the sentence was handed down, Feliciano was given the opportunity to provide a statement, but he turned down the offer. Outside of court, Prosecutor Bianchi expressed his deep sadness at the loss of Father Ed, a man whose life had been dedicated to serving others. He spoke of the senselessness of his death, stating, "This man's life was dedicated 24/7 to helping people. He died literally trying to protect God's children, and he paid for it with his own." 3 days later, a ceremony honouring Father Ed and other crime victims was held at St. Patrick's Church. There was an underlying tone of hope and resilience, with his friend Judith Ann Cook commenting, "Let us turn mourning into dancing." Around 150 people attended, including Prosecutor Bianchi. He stated, "Trying this case was probably the greatest honour I have ever had as a trial attorney." Prosecutor Bianchi was filled with a sense of purpose and determination, and just the following year, he opened up his own law practice with his father. Father Ed Hines was a shining example of kindness and compassion, always ready to lend a helping hand to those in need. When the idea was floated to fire Jose Feliciano, Father Ed refused to let that happen. He knew that he was struggling financially, and he went out of his way to ensure he remained employed. However, Feliciano Stark's secrets finally caught up with him, and instead of showing gratitude for everything that Father Ed had done for him, he repaid him in one final act of violence. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Katrienne, Becca, and Lauren. The support on there seriously goes such a long way, and I genuinely am eternally grateful. Please do check Morbidology out on Patreon if you'd like to support the show. But if you'd like to support the show in another way, you can leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.